Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the first part of a talk by Gabriel Bach, retired justice of the Israeli Supreme Court and a prosecutor at the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann in the spring of 1961. Justice Bach will deliver the Creighton University School of Law's International Law Lecture. The title of his presentation will be The 50th Anniversary of the Trial of Adolf Eichmann. Justice Bach's appearance was co-sponsored by the Institute for Holocaust Education, the QTAC Rock Foundation, the Heartland Holocaust Education Fund of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Anti-Defamation League, Plain States Region, the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Cardozo Society of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, Fraser Stryker Law Firm, the Klutznik Chair in Jewish Civilization at Creighton University, and Marks Claire Richards, LLC. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, the sponsoring organizations, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mary Ann Culhane, the Dean of the Creighton University School of Law.
We're gathered here today to greet and to learn from one of the most important visitors ever to honor this campus with a visit, Justice Gabriel Bach of Israel. Mike Kelly, the law school's Associate Dean for International Programs, worked tirelessly to arrange this visit, along with many sponsors. So it's only fair that Mike have the honor to introduce our speaker tonight. But I'd like to first say just a few words about Mike. He joined us at the law school 10 years ago. Given all that he's accomplished since then, I can't believe it's only been a decade. Mike came in with a BA and a JD from Indiana University and an LLM in international law from Georgetown. He taught for a while at Michigan State Law before coming to us. Here, he teaches a wide array of international law courses as well as Native American law. He's an active scholar, written 4 books, more than 30 articles, countless op-eds published around the nation. He's a frequent presenter and a consultant on international problems, especially his expertise in international criminal law. He's working to build a more peaceful future. He's a regular visitor to the Kurdish areas of Iraq, helping the Kurds draft a constitution. He was part of a Creighton Law team, well, Creighton University team, that works with USAID to sort out Cuban property claims so that when the Castro brothers finally lose their grip on that island nation, we'll have some guidance as to how to sort out the many claims. Mike's active in many international organizations where he meets wonderful people and brings the very best back to our campus, as we are about to see and hear. Thank you all for joining us tonight for this very special occasion. Mike, please step up and take over. Thank you for your work.
Thank you very much, Dean Culhane. That was a gracious introduction. I'd like to welcome you all to the Creighton University School of Law 2011 International Law Lecture. We're fortunate on occasion to have renowned jurists visit us from around the world and offer both insightful reflection and very interesting stories to share with us here in our local legal and academic community in Omaha. Past international law lecturers have included Judge Rod Jui Al-Saidi of the Iraqi High Tribunal, Chief Investigative Judge of the Saddam Hussein trials, and Judge Eugene Popovich of the European Court of Human Rights in Geneva, Switzerland. And this afternoon, we bring you Justice Gabriel Bach, formerly of the Israeli Supreme Court. The law school is also fortunate to have so many friends. Today's international law lecture is co-sponsored by the QTAC Rock Foundation, the Institute for Holocaust Education, the Heartland Holocaust Educational Fund of the Jewish Federation of Omaha Foundation, the Anti-Defamation League, Plain States Region, the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Cardozo Society of the Jewish Federation, the B'nai B'rith Henry Monsky Lodge, the Fraser Stryker Law Firm, the Klutznik Chair in Jewish Civilization here at Creighton University, and Marks Claire Richards, LLC. I must also recognize the tireless efforts of Beth Doton, Ron Kuttner, Alan Potash, and Bob Cohen for making this event happen. I visited with many of our co-sponsors throughout this process, and I particularly remember meeting Sam Fried for breakfast one morning at Market Basket. As many of you know, Sam is a survivor of Auschwitz. Sam was sitting at the table waiting for me in the restaurant, and in front of him was this binder dated 1961. It was the trial transcript of the Eichmann case. Sam had held on to it all these years. And I looked at him and I said, "Sam, this was meant to happen." And he looked back at me and he said, "I know," as only Sam could. Now, about our speaker, Justice Gabriel Bach was born in Germany in 1927. And in 1938, exactly 2 weeks before the night of broken glass, or Kristallnacht, the Bach family moved to Holland. 1 month before the German invasion of Holland in 1940, they relocated to Jerusalem. He's always been one step ahead of the game. He was later told he was the only Jew of his school in Amsterdam to have survived the war. Justice Bach studied law in England, receiving his Bachelor of Laws degree with honors from University College London, and was admitted to the bar in 1950 in Lincoln's Inn, England. Justice Bach sought a life of public service in the state attorney's office back in Israel. Aside from the Eichmann case, he also appeared in dozens of internationally known criminal and civil cases, like the Rohan case, which involved the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, major espionage cases, including the Meyer-Lansky case, the cases brought against Rabbi Kahana and Archbishop Capucci, and many cases of importance in constitutional law concerning the occupied areas. He later became the state attorney general for Israel. He has also presented Israeli interests before foreign courts, tribunals, and international conferences. In March 1982, he was appointed as a justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, a position he held until 1997, when he reached the mandatory retirement age. He is a colonel in the Israeli Army Reserves. He served in the Advocate General's Department for many years and continues to serve as a judge of the Army Court of Appeals. About the Eichmann case, 1961 was a momentous year in the annals of international jurisprudence. Adolf Eichmann, the notorious Nazi leader who had engineered the machinery of the Holocaust, had been captured and brought to Jerusalem to stand trial for his crimes against humanity and against the Jewish people. His trial opened on April 11, 1961. The next day, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space. 5 days after that, the Bay of Pigs invasion had begun. Yet with such momentous events swirling around us, Israelis and the world paid attention to what was happening in Jerusalem in this historic trial, in the capital city of a new and besieged country, only 13 years old, hewn from the sands of the Levant, hard by the eastern Mediterranean Sea. Adolf Eichmann was born in 1914, the son of a middle-class businessman, Karl Eichmann. He joined the Austrian branch of the SS in 1932 when he was 18 years old and later accepted as a full SS member. His SS number was 45326. 2 years later, he had joined Heyerdahl's SD, the elite party security service. His initial task was to collect information on prominent Freemasons in Germany, but he was soon assigned to the Jewish section. His voluntary immigration program evolved into a policy of forced deportation by the outbreak of World War II. It was during this period that he proposed his plan to deport all Jews to the island of Madagascar off the coast of East Africa. That plan was obviously never adopted. But Eichmann's logistical prowess during the war, coupled with his growing power, secured him the post-war sobriquet as the architect of the Holocaust. By war's end, he had been captured by the U.S. Army, but the Americans did not know his true identity. He slipped out of U.S. custody in 1946 and hid in Germany for two more years. By 1948, he had obtained a landing permit for Argentina, but could not use it without a visa. So he then left for Italy, and by 1950, he was posing as a refugee named Ricardo Clement. Eichmann then obtained a humanitarian passport from the Red Cross, together with his visa for Argentina, and sailed by ship for South America on July 14, 1950. For the next decade, he continued his secret life, working in various jobs in and around Buenos Aires, including stints in a factory, laundry business, as a water engineer, and even as a rabbit farmer. He had also managed to relocate his family to be with him. It was during this time that Israeli intelligence had begun to follow leads in his direction, and by 1960, they had devised plans to capture him, which they did on May 11th of that year, as Eichmann was returning home from work. He was snatched from the street, gagged, blindfolded, bundled into a car, and taken to a Mossad safe house, where he remained for a week, awaiting the next regularly scheduled El Al flight back to Israel. Getting him out of the country without alerting the Argentinian authorities was a challenge. The intelligence unit sent one of their own agents to the hospital with possible brain damage from an alleged car accident. By May 20th, the agent had shown sufficient progress to be discharged and flown home to his native Israel. Mossad then substituted Eichmann's assumed name and photograph on the discharge form, drugged him, and boarded the plane to Tel Aviv dressed as El Al employees. He was then transported to Israel to be prosecuted in Jerusalem as a war criminal. Security was tight, and Eichmann appeared in the dock accompanied by two uniformed guards behind a bulletproof glass at all times. Justice Bach was appointed to the position of senior prosecutor for the trial that began in the spring of 1961. He was the lead coordinator for the investigation of Eichmann's crimes, acting as the legal advisor to the police bureau and preparing the case for trial. He served as one of three principal prosecutors during the trial of Eichmann, one of the most significant trials in the annals of criminal justice. And here we are in 2011, commemorating the 50th anniversary of that historic occasion. From unspeakable crimes in Nazi-occupied Europe to a hiding place in Latin America to a trial in the Middle East, to this commemoration in Omaha, Nebraska. I have a newsreel from the opening day in court that captures the first moments.
In Jerusalem, the trial of Adolf Eichmann begins, reviving memories of the Nazi horrors of the Second World War. Entering the bulletproof prisoner's box is the man charged with the annihilation of millions of Jews in Nazi death camps. Searching problems of conscience and of international law will be raised by this trial, one of the most stirring of modern times. Eichmann himself is impassive as the three judges who will decide his fate enter. Now, after 15 years in hiding and 1 year after his sensational abduction from Argentina, Adolf Eichmann is indicted on 15 counts of crimes against the Jewish people and crimes against humanity.
He accused, together with others, during the period 1939 to 1945, caused the killing of millions of Jews in his capacity as the person responsible for the execution of the Nazi plan for the physical extermination of the Jews, known as the final solution of the Jewish problem.
Eichmann's attorney, Dr. Robert Savatius, opens by denying the legality of the trial and questions the jurisdiction obtained by Eichmann's forcible capture. Dr. Savatius further suggests that Eichmann be tried by a neutral or international tribunal. Israeli Attorney General Gideon Hausner, the chief prosecutor, replies that no one except the State of Israel has sought to bring Eichmann to justice and cites the Nuremberg war crimes trials as precedent for this trial. Throughout, Eichmann remains icy calm, his fate at last in the scales of justice.
I always love that dramatic music from those newsreels. And now it is my distinct honor and pleasure to give you Justice Gabriel Bach of Israel.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks, all of you, for inviting my wife and me to this lovely city. Actually, we've never been in this part of the United States before, and we really enjoy every moment we arrived. Also, the lovely way in which we've been received by everyone that we have met. Now, I am very often asked whether I regard myself as one of the Holocaust survivors. In a way, I mean, yes or no. I mean, you heard part of my history, but I just want to add a few things. I mean, I was born in a little city in Germany called Halberstadt, but as I often say, at the early age of 2 months, I decided to leave Halberstadt. My father was working in heavy industry, and he was then working for a big factory in this place, Halberstadt, but that moved then to Berlin, and later became the director general in charge of the whole of that factory. So actually, while I was in Germany, I only knew Berlin. And my father was also one of the leading Zionists of Germany. So when I grew up, I ironically went to the Theodor Herzl School of Adolf Hitler Square. You know, Theodor Herzl, one of the leaders of the founders of the Zionist movement. And I went to that school until we left. And the school is still, the building still exists. It's now Radio Berlin. And the manageress of that school was a lady called Paula Fürst. And she, in 1938, when some of the children could go to England in what they called a transportation of children, she went there. But then in 1939, after the outbreak of war, she heard that there were some children of that school who were still there and couldn't get out. So she went back against all advice and warning. She went back to Berlin to save these children, but she was caught and she was brought to Auschwitz and she was killed there. As you heard, we left in 1938, 2 weeks before the Kristallnacht when all Jews were arrested. In fact, we wanted to leave before. We had already left our home. We were already in a hotel to leave for Holland, which at first was the first place because my father had an office there in connection with the factory that he worked for. But then the Czechoslovak crisis broke. And the German SS came in and took our passports away. Afterwards, it was explained that they knew that my father was an expert on heavy industry, and they thought war might break out, and they didn't want my father to be abroad to know new details about the German heavy industry, and that's why we couldn't leave. And then Chamberlain came to Munich, as most of you will remember from history, and there was this capitulation of Chamberlain to Hitler at the time, and Czechoslovak was captured then by the Germans. And there was a temporary lull, and we got our passports back. So nowadays, when Chamberlain is criticized for that capitulation to Hitler, I rationally agree with that, but I keep quiet, because there is no doubt that it saved our lives. And then we went to Holland, and But then the Crystal Knights started, and all my uncles from my mother and my father's side were arrested by the Germans, and they were in Dachau, in Buchenwald, the famous concentration camps. But my father managed to save them all, because of his connection to the Zionist movement, he managed to get entry certificates for all the family from all these places. But we didn't want to leave Holland before we had saved the whole of that family. And that it took some time. But what I also can never forget, as you have heard, we left Holland in 1940, 1 month before the German invasion. And we came then to Palestine on the ship, the Patria, which was sunk on the next journey after that with 250 people killed. So we were always sort of one step ahead. And what really gave me the shivers, I later, 20 years later, when I appeared in the Eichmann trial, my best friend in Holland, who is not Jewish, he saw me on television, and he contacted me. I mean, in Holland, I went to a mixed school, but there were hundreds of Jewish pupils as well in all the classes. And this friend of mine, I invited him to Israel, and he came and he told me that after the war, he made some research, and he found out that of all the Jewish pupils in our school, that I'm apparently the only one who remained alive. And then what even more gave me the shivers, I later read in history books that between the outbreak of war in 39 and March 40, when we left Holland, Hitler had fixed 7 times a date for the invasion of Holland. And every time he postponed it at the last minute. Once the astrologers had told him that the star situation was unfavorable. Once they heard something on the BBC and they thought the British were suspecting something. A number of times weather conditions were bad. So 7 times when we were still in Holland, there was a date for the invasion by the Germans, and Hitler postponed it at the very last minute. And then the 8th time when they did come in, we just left Holland. So really the idea, what life depends on, gives you sort of really room for thought. Everyone in Palestine and Israel thought that we that my father had a sort of sixth sense as to when to leave a place. So when, as many of you will remember from history, when the German army during the war approached Palestine from Libya and Egypt, were approaching Palestine under General Rommel, the famous German general, everyone came to my father and they said, "Where do we go now?" So my father said, "Here is the last stop. Here we won't budge." So then the Germans had to go back. Now you see the real reasons behind this. Don't take me so seriously. But this is what people said, that there must have been some kind of connection. Yeah, anyway, I later studied law in England. Actually, I finished school in... I was actually bar mitzvah, you know. I'm 13 years old on my way on this ship, the Patria, to Palestine, as it then was. I later went to school, I then studied law, I'm an English barrister, I had some very interesting time there as well. Then I joined the Israel Army, and then the State Attorney's Office, and later it was the Justice of the Supreme Court. During my legal service, really, I never had routine cases. It was always a series of adventures, really, one after another. I don't complain about that, the contrary. But it's, of course, difficult, even like that, to give you a complete description. So I want to concentrate now on the case which still holds for me the largest number of moments of interest and trauma, but also of excitement and satisfaction. And that was the case of Adolf Eichmann. I was at that time the deputy state attorney of Israel. I had already appeared in quite a number of big espionage and other interesting formal cases. But I must tell you, of all those, the only case where a day doesn't pass without me being reminded of some aspect of that case is the Eichmann trial. Again, I mean, there's here so many points, legal points, historical points, moral points, emotional points. It's of course, impossible to cover that all. What I would like to join with you tonight are some of the points that I think were the most crucial and important things, and the ones that are most stuck in my memory and connected with certain emotions which sort of accompany me all the time. Now, first of all, you know, the first moment when Eichmann was brought, I had no idea that he was caught, when he was brought from the Argentine by Israeli agents into Israel. And Ben-Gurion, our prime minister, in the Knesset, our parliament, made a statement, and that was broadcast by radio. I heard it then, that this man, responsible for the carrying out of the Holocaust, that he is in Israel and will stand trial for the offenses that he committed. That had an electrifying effect all over the country, and I was certainly part of that. I also knew quite a lot about Eichmann before that, because I don't know, many of you may have heard about it, there was a famous Kastner case. That was someone, Kastner was one of the Zionist leaders in Hungary during the war. And he had carried out some negotiation with Eichmann about the saving about 1,400 Jews. And someone charged him that he was a traitor and that he cooperated with the Nazis and that he was a criminal. And there was a libel case brought against the person who said that. At first, the case was lost by the prosecution. But then I was asked by the then Attorney General to prepare the appeal, and I dealt for months with the appeal. We won that appeal, but before the judgment was given by the Supreme Court in favor of the memory of Kastner, he was murdered by someone in Israel. I mean, that was a very tragic affair, but and I dealt with it quite a lot, and therefore, I knew quite a lot about Eichmann, but of course not to the same extent that I learned about it later. So 2 days after Eichmann was brought to Israel, the Minister of Justice, Pinchas Rosen, he called me and he said, Mr. Bach, would you be prepared to be the legal advisor of the police bureau that was entrusted with the investigation against Eichmann? I gladly agreed to that. And they vacated a whole prison not far from Haifa. I mean, we live in Jerusalem. That is pretty far away. But so all during the week, I was away from home. I was in a hotel in Haifa, but every morning I went to that prison. So for 9 months, I actually lived next to Eichmann in that prison, where he was kept together with some 30 or 40 police officers. Every police officer had either a certain country of Europe which he had to investigate, or some topic, like the theft of the property or the transportation to the death camps or the death camps, etc. And so my ruling was that every evening, I mean, they went through millions of documents, and every evening I insisted that every police officer brought to me all the documents that they thought might be relevant to the Eichmann trial, and I had to decide what will be included and what will not be included by the case of the prosecution. I also, at the time, I was the only contact Eichmann had with the outside world until his lawyers came. But I let him know that if he had some technical problem or some formal problem that he wanted to discuss, he could come to me and I would hear what he had to say and try to give him advice, but that I was not prepared to talk to him about the alleged offenses with which he was charged, because then I would have to be a witness. And I knew I would be one of the prosecutors in the trial. So I said I would not talk to him about the offenses themselves. So at first, I didn't meet him at all. But I'll never forget my first meeting with him. I was on that day sitting in my office in this prison, and I was reading the autobiography of a man called Rudolf Höss, not Hess, the assistant of Hitler, but Höss, O-E-S-S. He was the commander of the Auschwitz death camp, and he was hanged in Poland by the Polish, first sentenced to death and then by the Polish authorities in 1948, 12 years before Eichmann was brought into Israel. But before he was executed, he wrote his biographical notes. And I was reading those on that day, and there I saw that he described how they had very many days where they had to kill 1,000 Jewish children a day. And he described how the children used to kneel down very often and ask to be saved. And then he described, they said, when I had to push the children together with my colleagues, when we had to push the children into the gas chambers, my knees were getting a bit wobbly sometimes. But then he added, but I always felt afterwards ashamed of this weakness of mine after I talked to Obersturmbannführer Adolf Eichmann, that was his rank in the SS. He says, because Eichmann explained to me that it's especially the children who have to be killed first. He says, because where is the logic that you kill a generation of older people and you leave alive a generation of possible avengers who might afterwards create that race again? Now, maybe that's not devoid of some macabre kind of logic, but 10 minutes after I read that, a policeman came in and said, Adolf Eichmann wants to see you. So I must tell you, when I heard his steps outside and he was sitting opposite me a yard away after I just read that, it was not so easy to keep a poker face at that particular moment. But that was my first direct meeting. On that day, he wanted to consult me on the question of a lawyer that, you know, the Israel government had declared that they would be responsible financially and otherwise for his defense. And his family suggested that Dr. Savatius, who was one of the leading defense counsels in the Nuremberg trials, that he would... they suggested that he should take him, and Eichmann wanted to consult me whether legally that was possible under Israeli law. Now, I mean, that was my one impression. The other thing is, you know, it's not known also in Israel because, of course, they saw only the final results and final evidence. But, you know, during the investigation, there was always an attempt in every country to sometimes save one particular Jew or one particular Jewish family. And that, whether it was in France or in Holland or Slovakia or Greece, there were attempts by people to apply to Eichmann's department that someone should be, for certain reasons that I quote some of them, should not be sent to the death camps. And so whenever a police officer came across a document like that, of course, he brought it to me immediately in the evening. But, I mean, all these, the German government was very cooperative, and they sent us all the relevant files from every ministry, from the SS and the army and from every place in Europe. This was all part of big files, and these files were in chronological order. So if someone applied to Eichmann on a certain date, it took a few days until the police officer brought me the reply of Eichmann. There were sometimes hundreds or thousands of documents in between. So I had dreams that night that, you know, sometimes one particular family or one particular person might be saved. And I woke up in the morning, I thought someone was saved, and then without a single exception, the moment something got to Eichmann, the answer was always negative and was almost fatal. I don't want to be too technical. I just give you some examples. One day, the policeman responsible for France, he came to me and he brought me a telegram sent by a German general, the commander of Paris. And that general of the Wehrmacht, the general of the German army, applied to Eichmann and informed him that there was a Jewish professor, Professor Weiss, an expert on radar, and that Jew has made a number of inventions, had some patents in his name. And it was very important for the German army to examine that Jew and to compare it with the work of the German scientists. And therefore, this general insisted that this professor and his wife should not be deported to Auschwitz. As I said here, I was sure in the middle of the war, one Jewish person, an expert on radar, important for the German army, a general demanding that. How he cannot possibly refuse. Anyway, a few days later, the reply of Eichmann, on a point of view of principle, I cannot possibly agree. A few days later, a note that general had called Eichmann by telephone. He said, how dare you countermand my orders? I am a general of the army. And the answer of Eichmann, and I am an Obersturmbannführer of the SS, and I don't care what rank you have in the army. A few days later, Eichmann writes, I have examined the matter further, and I found that the German army has already taken over the patents of this Jew Weiss. Therefore, I see no reason even for one more day to postpone the deportation of that Jew. And then a note that, in fact, this man and his wife had been deported to their death, had been deported to Auschwitz, and had been killed there. I also want to tell you, we divided up the work amongst us, the three of us, the Attorney General Gideon Hausner, and I was number two, and the District Attorney of Tel Aviv, Mr. Bar-Or, he was number three, and we divided up the countries. As I was responsible for the investigation, of course, the things that had sort of direct contact with Eichmann, these were witnesses that usually I questioned in court. Anyway, the whole of Western Europe and Hungary and were part of what I had to do. Amongst other things, France. So during the trial, I handed, amongst other things, of course, I handed these documents about Professor Weiss as part of the evidence. A few days later, my secretary came to me and said, there's a young lady outside wants to see you. Who is that? Aliza Weiss, don't know her. Anyway, she came in and she said, you know, I'm the daughter of this Professor Weiss. I was a baby when they took my parents away. And my parents apparently saw that they were coming, so they sent me to neighbors. And the neighbors kept me and sent me to America. And in America, I read that you put in these documents about my parents. Now, not only didn't I know my parents, I haven't got even a picture of what they looked like. Could you give me some advice how I can get at least a picture of what they looked like? One case. Another one. The person responsible for Holland, he came to me and he brought me a letter written by the leader of the fascist party in Holland, the fascist party. And apparently there were some cranks, there were some 12 Jews who were members of that party, of the fascist party in Holland. So that leader of that party wrote to Eichmann that it gave the names of these Jewish people, and they said, we demand that they should not be deported. It will be demoralizing to all the members of our party if these people are sent away. They are loyal members of the party, and we don't want to lose them. To make it even more pleasant and attractive to Eichmann, he even added, bring some kind of benefit to you people. They might do intelligence work inside the Jewish community, and they might help you find all the Jews that are in Holland. To make it more attractive for Eichmann. Again, I thought under those circumstances, hard to imagine that he can refuse. The answer of Eichmann, president of principle, I cannot possibly agree. He added, if you think it will be demoralizing for the fascist party if they are sent away this week, let's wait 3 or 4 weeks. By then, people will have got used to the deportation of the Jews to such an extent that no one will pay any particular attention anymore. Just one more thing, which shook me not less. One day, they gave me a telegram sent by the Italian consul in Lithuania. He informed Eichmann that there was a Jewish woman, an Italian, a Jewish woman, and she, her parents lived in Lithuania, and she apparently had just visited her parents in Lithuania, and she had been caught there by the Germans, and they wanted to send her also to the death camps. So this Italian wrote that this woman is the widow of a high Italian officer who was particularly brave and courageous during the war, and he fell in the fighting during the war. And all Italy is speaking about that man, what a brave and wonderful officer that was. And therefore, the Italian authorities insist that this woman, this widow, should be given the chance to return to Italy. So Eichmann, again, question of principle, I cannot possibly agree, and they saw it to it that this woman was sent to her death. Now here, if you remember, I mean, of course you remember, Italy was the ally, after all, of Germany. And here was this officer of the Italian army who distinguished himself and who fell fighting on the side of the Germans. And all we hear this, he was informed that the Italian authorities, the ally of Germany, that they insisted that this woman should be given a chance to return to Italy. Now, even that was prevented. Now, multiply that 100 of times, and you can imagine, I mean, the trauma that went through us when I had to every day to examine a case like that. If I speak of trauma, you know, we wanted to have evidence from all over the world, but I was especially interested to get information from Poland, where the death camps were, and the gas chambers, etc. And we wanted to know about the people who were sent there and their numbers and what happened and so on. Now, the Polish government was very anti-Israel at the time, and they gave instructions that no one should help us, should cooperate with us. But there were many Poles who wanted to help us, so they sent us information and evidence anonymously, without disclosing who they were. So one day I received a letter with typewritten pages, and there was the number of Jews in 1942 and 1943, who every day, how many Jews came to Auschwitz, and what numbers were given to them on their arms. Now, that, of course, was of extreme importance, but in order to hide their identity, they'd sent me these typewritten pages without a stamp, without a signature, without any evidence where this came from. Now, you don't have to be a lawyer or a jurist but to understand that you, in a criminal case, you cannot use documents that where you don't know where they come from and to what extent they are true or not. But this was so important. It showed here the murder of millions of people. So I asked for a meeting of all the police officers in this prison. And when we were collected, I showed them these documents. And I asked them, has any of you an idea how we might change this into legitimate and admissible evidence? It was silence. But then I had an idea. I said, look, maybe we do the opposite what we usually do. Usually someone who prepares a document, someone who's, where there is a stamp, where there is this, then we show how true it is. But maybe we show that, in fact, this document is true. There are hundreds of Israelis who were in Auschwitz. They still have the number on their arms. They remember when they got to Auschwitz. Now, if you say, for instance, if you, the police, you write, you publish, that any Jewish person in Israel who was at Auschwitz and who came there in July 1942, that he should come to the police and ask them when they arrived there and look at the figure on their arms. And then you can see whether, in fact, what's in this document, whether it's a true document or not a true document. I had not yet finished saying that, and the police officer in charge of Poland pulled up the sleeve of his shirt, and he showed us a number. And he said, I came to Auschwitz in September 43. And that was exactly the number, and this was the date, and that exactly fits in with what's in this document. Now, I had no idea that this man came from Poland. I certainly had no idea that he had been in Auschwitz. But I had the impression that he hadn't told his friends in the police, the other officers either, about this. Now, police officers are not known as very weak kind of persons. But when he pulled up that sleeve, you know, for about 2 or 3 minutes, all these police officers were absolutely silent. You know, when you speak of moments that are difficult to forget. I mean, this also was one of those.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the first part of a talk by Gabriel Bach, retired justice of the Israeli Supreme Court and a prosecutor at the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann in the spring of 1961. The title of his presentation is The 50th Anniversary of the Trial of Adolf Eichmann. Justice Bach delivered the Creighton University School of Law's International Law Lecture. His appearance was co-sponsored by the Institute for Holocaust Education, the QTAC Rock Foundation, the Heartland Holocaust Education Fund of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Anti-Defamation League, Plain States Region, the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, the Cardozo Society of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, Fraser Stryker Law Firm, the Klutznik Chair in Jewish Civilization at Creighton University, and Marks Claire Richards, LLC. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 22, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Listen tomorrow at 12 o'clock noon for the second part of Justice Bach's lecture. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.